Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have, well, we'll have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, the most recent five are archived at the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Now let's get started. You know, this time we're going to talk about willingness to change, the capacity to really change course, to really change what you thought you were going to do, to really change your opinion maybe even. And you know, these shows are always created because of questions that are asked. They're not scripted. They're kind of organic. And that's one of the things that people have been asking about. We've been talking about all kinds of ways of encouragement and all kinds of ways to get participation. And a lot of people are asking, well, what happens if it's not working? If we really need to change? If we really need to do something completely different? And we've already started down one path, and it's not quite working. We're not having success, and we can see that something needs to be done. So I think our first question, yeah, people, a lot of people, thank you for all of your participation. I see a lot of you are here already. Thank you. Thank you for coming. And I think our first question is, how do we create change? Yeah, it's kind of the base question, isn't it? It's the foundation. How do we create change? How do we allow that to happen? Because change is hard, right? We all like to think that we know what we're doing. Yeah, especially me. No, we all like to think that we know what we're doing, right? And so to really have to change is, well, it's a concept. Mm-hmm. You know, Helen says this is really the basic answer to the basic question. How do we create change? Helen says, by being open to new ideas. What a concept. By being open to new ideas. That's really how you create change, isn't it? By being willing to create change. By being willing and open to new ideas. Mm-hmm. We're getting a lot of agreement to that. Thank you, Helen. That's a nice way of putting it, but a lot of you did indeed say basically the same thing. This is true. By being open to new ideas is how do we create change. Mm-hmm. And Adam and others are saying not only being open to new ideas, but by listening to the opinions of others. Being open to new ideas and listening to the opinions of others. Yeah, you got to be open to listening, right? To thinking about what somebody else thinks and whether or not, even if it's completely different, you know, a lot of times, even after all these years, a lot of times when you have a group, a seminar, a workshop, a mediation, even an arbitration, when you get there, you have kind of an idea, right, of what's going to happen and what the outcome is going to be. But when you listen to somebody else's opinion, a lot of times you go, wow, I didn't think of that. Look at that. Somebody has said something that, well, you got to think on, because that wasn't at all what you thought. And you never thought of that angle. You never thought of that part of it. You never thought of that impact, perhaps. So being open to new ideas and listening to the opinions of others. Oh, now here's a wonderful answer that Callie is saying, that you need to be open and listen. But Callie says you create change by not being insulted by criticism. Ooh. By not being insulted by criticism. Yes, one needs to be gracious, right? Well, even if you think the criticism is, yeah, people are going, it depends. Yes, I know I say that a lot. But if you, and this is a very good point that's also being made, if it's just criticism because somebody's nasty and it's off target, well, that's different. But when somebody tells you that you're wrong or you're not doing it right, well, you have to be open, right, and listen, right, because they might have a point. Now, some people are more diplomatic in their criticism, and this is being pointed out. Thank you for all of your comments, and we're getting agreement, but also we're getting caveats to Kelly's statement, not being insulted by criticism. And the caveats are that it depends, really, how the criticism is presented, right? Now, there's some of us in this world who can tell you you're wrong in a very diplomatic manner. And there's some of this in this world, and of course, this is what we advocate, right? Because that's why we have all the convivial timeouts, where we have some food and some, well, we'll call it networking. But it's also for the host to privately, the leader, to privately, or even someone's peers, yes, to privately talk to someone and mention that they're, well, they're not being very helpful, okay? Helpful to the process, we'll call it that, right? It's a moment away, a time out, so that we can say any kind of, well, as Callie says, criticism, but any kind of comments in private. I think that's a very good idea. And as the leader, the host, we can call a time out when we need to say something to somebody, right? Right. So I think you should always, of course, as Callie says, not be insulted by criticism that is just a private comment, and we need to be, of course, diplomatic, right? Yes. We can't just be rude, even in private. And some people are more capable of diplomacy than others. But I would never think of criticizing someone in public unless they were being, and we have talked about this before, by the way, prior shows, the last five on the website, Recipe for Peace Now, all of them archived on the radio station, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow, if you want to hear what we've talked about kind of extensively before. But the concept is that if someone is being deliberately obstructive to the process, that's different than just having a private talk about don't do that or we need to get along in this particular instance, you see. But yeah, public is different than private, is the point that's being made by a lot of people. Thank you for all of your participation. And Kelly says, yes, she didn't mean it as somebody was really nasty in public. But it's always best if you have something to say to someone to do it during one of the breaks, to do it during one of the timeouts, right? Right. Public criticism, you can't be insulted by that either. I'm usually good-humored the first time. And kind of maybe a wee bit sarcastic if it's just criticism for criticism's sake. But we don't want to make a habit of it in public, right? Just because it delays the process and it is unnecessary. And usually intrusive, right? So one has to be diplomatic about criticism. But yes, if someone tells you something that they sincerely think that you are not doing right, or they sincerely think that you're wrong, that not even a behavioral thing, but an opinion. They really, really think that you're wrong, and they have a reason for it, and they tell you about it. You cannot be insulted by that. That is something for you to think on. And I usually say, yes, I will think about that. Thank you for telling me. Yeah. We're getting some dissension about being insulted by criticism. I tend to think that the leader should try not to be insulted by anything because it stops the process potentially. Mm-hmm. And we, of course, are good examples to the rest of the people, right? Right. So we have to remember that we are good examples and we are always calm. Mm-hmm. We never get nasty or huffy or anything because we're good examples and we're pushing the process forward. And we will prevent disruption into the process. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a balance between calm, not being insulted, being open to new ideas, and listening, because criticism is a new idea and listening too, right? And being open to it. Between being not insulted and calm, but maintaining control of the situation. Yeah, people are talking about that, and thank you, that's a real good point, that there comes a point where you have to assert control, right? And that's why we have rules. That's why we have rules about how long you can speak, about how you need to act towards your fellow participant. Yeah, we've got rules, and we enforce them, right? We are fair to everybody, to equal, and we don't want somebody to hijack the process. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a balancing act about criticism. I tend to even enforce my own rule, depending on the group. I know you guys say I say it depends a lot, but it does. It depends. It depends on the situation in the group. I think one of my rules is, although I don't state it like that all the time, is that if you're going to be critical of somebody's opinion or style, really a criticism and not just an argument with your own opinion, really like a personal criticism, that's something for private. You don't do that in public. Mm-hmm. That's something between the two of you, as they say, and not something that you stand up and do during the meeting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not being insulted by criticism. Mm-hmm. You know, John and others are saying that the key is that understand a different position, even if you don't agree with it. Ah, how do we create change? By understanding a different position, even if you don't agree with it. Yeah, you don't have to change your opinion just because somebody else has an opinion, right? Pardon me. But you need to understand that that's really what they think. And where it's coming from, so to speak. Why? Why do they think that? Now, that's not my opinion, but I understand your opinion. It's valid. Let's work together and reach compromise, right? We create change by understanding a different opinion, even if we don't agree with it. What a good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Sandy and others are making an excellent point. We have so far talked about change in ourselves, right? Change of our opinion, our ability to listen, our ability to be open to new ideas, and to not be insulted, right? And understanding a different position. Now, Sandy and others are making a very good point that it's not just personal change. In fact, it's generally not. Good point. Because we're not doing life coaching here. We're doing group dynamic, right? She says, it's not just our change. You need to encourage change in others because it's group change. Ah, what concepts? Not our change. You need to encourage change in others. Mm-hmm. And Alex says that you need to let go of your stubbornness and have others understand to let go of theirs. Sometimes it's true. I know that we would never do this, right? But sometimes people come with a set opinion, people are calling it a set agenda, and that's a very good word for it. Thank you for all of your participation, by the way. We have lots and lots of participation. Thank you very much. And they come with a set agenda, which Alex is kind of calling stubbornness, He says, let go of stubbornness. And the set agenda, they listen, they hear other opinions, the other opinions have a point. But they hate to let go of what they thought because they thought it beforehand, and it's easy to still think it. So they have, everybody has to be open to, as Alex says, letting go of their stubbornness, including us, right? Because otherwise the group will not reach consensus. And consensus is really change, right? It's changing from individual opinions, individually held dear, stubborn opinions of individuals into a consensus as a group. It's natural change. Yeah, it's part of the process. Mm-hmm. Mariana says to encourage new strategic thinking. Well, that's what groups do, right? They do strategic thinking. And then people think about it in their off time when they're not in the group. And then we all go forward. We think about it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a good point. Thomas and others are saying that you need to allow change in others and not assume that you know what they're thinking. That goes to our concept of stereotype, kind of, doesn't it? Thomas, we're getting a lot of agreement that you need to allow change in others. Yeah, you can't just think that they're going to do the same thing. You need to allow change in others and not assume that you know what they are thinking. That's a very good point. You can't assume, because people go, well, you're in this group, this religion, this culture, whatever. I know what you're going to say. Well, how do you know that? And what they said at the beginning when the process first started, maybe they've changed. Maybe they've modified. Maybe we're reaching consensus as a group, and it's a natural progression. Yes, it's a wonderful thing. So now that we've gotten this far, let's talk about how you make a group a capacity to change. How do we encourage group capacity to change? Because after all, that's what we really are. We're pieces of a group, and we have to change together so that we can make consensus and we can go forward to get our goals accomplished, right? And, you know, Bethany and others, and this is a very good point, we've talked about preconceived notions at different times on this show. In fact, there's a whole show on it. If you want to hear archive show, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeace now. I don't think we've talked about it within the last five, which are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. But we've, a preconceived notion, and thank you for all of the returning people. Thank you for all the new people. Thank you for all of your participation. Wow. And a preconceived notion is really the opinion that you came in with, right? Before you ever got to the group, before you ever talked to anybody else, in order to have joined, in order to be part of whatever it is, the seminar, the workshop, the mediation, whatever it is you're doing, in order to have joined it, you must have had a reason. And that reason is oftentimes a preconceived notion of what is going to be done, right? Right. And so Bethany and the others are saying that you get a group to change, encourage it, by abandoning preconceived notions of what will happen. That's a good point. As a leader, I think we try not to have too many preconceived notions about what will happen. But, I mean, we're human beings. We have an opinion about what's going to occur, right? So it's a good point. You need to abandon your preconceived notions of what will happen. And first, a lot of people are saying yes, but first you have to acknowledge your preconceived notions. Yeah, you got to think about it. Think about where you're starting from and how the group is going to change together. Mm-hmm. Have the capacity to change together. Right. Mm-hmm. Steve and others are making a very good corollary point that you need to be careful not to impose your opinions on the group because you're the leader. Very good point. We are often the strongest, I'll call it. We're the leader, right? We can get people swayed to our opinion because we're one of the stronger people in the group. And we all know that there are some people in any group who are kind of followers and some people who are leaders. And as the host and as people, well, all right, as people that listen to the show regularly, we are leaders. We're the people that are really putting the process forward. And yes, you have to be careful not to impose your opinion on the group because of your position within the group. Mm-hmm. Yeah. People are saying, what if your opinion is right? Well, you have to think about that because sometimes it is true that you have an opinion about the process, about going forward, about what needs to be done that is based on experience and quite valid. Mm-hmm. But you have to think about whether you're kind of making the group of your opinion, and if that's good, and if you've actually been open and listened, and really have thought through the other opinions. Mm-hmm. You know, the point has been made that sometimes there's not that many ways to go, that there's not that many other opinions. That's good. That means you're going to reach consensus quickly and know what to do. Mm-hmm. Not opposing your opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, Lisa and others are making a good point that groups and the consensus of everyone and openness and being open and listening, that change gradually occurs during the process with groups. Mm-hmm. The change gradually occurs during the process, naturally, yes. Groups, individuals change their position, their opinion, their ideas, they come together, everybody puts in their ideas and opinions, and people think thoughts that they hadn't thought to begin with. And there's a natural progression towards consensus. And that is change. It's a good point. That change occurs gradually during the process. Yes, if it's being done right, and it is, of course, because we're doing it, change will occur somewhat naturally. It's part of the whole process, the group change, the group consensus, the group kind of thinking as one to get to the ultimate conclusion, to get to the success. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a good point. You see this? I hadn't thought about it. When we talked about group change, I considered it the opinions and the ideas coming together and forming within what Lisa refers to as the process, and other people do too. I thought of it more as a coalescence between the people. But Hama has a very good point, and quite a few others are making it too, that we're talking about psychological change, you know, opinion and process and gradual. But groups often literally change their members. Yeah, people come and go. You can, if the process is going to take a little while, or if the group is made up of people in the workplace of a certain level, for example, mm-hmm, that the groups can literally change, the members change, and it creates a new group dynamic. Yes, that's a very good point, and I see this is a new thought, right? And we're open to it. I didn't really think of it in a literal manner, but of course that's true. Depending on the group, oftentimes the membership changes. Even if, and the smaller the group, the more that impacts the group dynamic, right? Because a huge group, a small percentage of people might not make much difference. But a small group, one person can make a big difference if they literally change, because it affects the group dynamic. And also, the new person has new ideas, right? Yeah, people are saying even a new preconceived notion. Yeah, they're coming in with an opinion. Mm-hmm. And they need to be brought up to speed about what we have done so far. And they need to be open and interested with the other group members. And they may have either a new opinion or an opinion that they want revisited. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes, a lot of times, actually, groups literally change. And you are absolutely right. It does create a difference in the group dynamic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Catherine and other people are saying that group expertise shifts during the negotiation process as different mentors are called upon for different skills. Good point. Group expertise shifts. We learn stuff from each other, right? During the negotiation process, as different members are called upon for different skills. Yeah, a lot of times there are more than one type of expert in a group. They have an expert opinion. We don't even have to hire out for it. And our expertise just, that's, you know, we've talked about research and subcommittees, so to speak, smaller groups that have been assigned to do something, making a report to the larger group about something they have discovered. Research, okay, how it was done successfully before is a good thing to know, right? We don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. Oh, good point. People are saying how it was done unsuccessfully before is even more interesting. How come that failed? And we're not going to do that. Let's try a different path, a different concept, right? Yeah. So group expertise shifts as we get more research, as we get more expert opinion. Mm-hmm. It's a natural progression. Mm-hmm. You know, this is an interesting question that's being asked. And you know these shows are organic and not scripted, so we're gonna go with the next set of questions. Basically speaking, pardon me, a lot of people are asking, what happens when you've got a complete shift? Because the group or the individual path is impossible. It's not working. It's being unsuccessful. What happens when we start out in one direction, and whoops, it's not working. We've gone in the wrong direction. And it's just not, we can't seem to reach consensus. We can't get, we try to connect with some sort of authorities, and it's not working. You know, a lot of times it's an outsider that we're trying to influence. And if the path, what we're doing just isn't working. What happens when you need to shift the whole thing? Mm-hmm. Kyle says, this is an interesting point, a lot of people saying it's nasty, but Kyle says that you have turmoil first, because we're all confused, because we knew what we were doing, right? And by golly, it just isn't working. He says you have turmoil first, and then to survive, you need to survive and go forward, and in order to do that, you must change. Mm-hmm. So you go, yeah, you need, the group kind of goes into turmoil, doesn't it? Goes kind of, oh, this isn't working, when, you know. And then you need to get together and decide what to do and change, right, in order to go forward. Mm-hmm. Jennifer Nietzsche says that you need to create a consensus for the new direction. Yeah, you need to create agreement that that's what we're going to be doing now, because what we've been doing in the past just isn't working. Mm-hmm. You know, David and others are making a real good point that groups are not, well, it depends on your group. You see, if it's really like a compliance workshop or a seminar or something, you've got a set group of people. They're your students, so to speak, right? But if it's a voluntary group, that David and others make a good point that oftentimes if it's really not working and you came with a set idea and you've worked towards that idea that you've all agreed upon, if it's just failing, a lot of times the group can dissolve. It will. Sometimes it can't be kept together. You know, and you need to kind of dissolve that group and then regroup into a new group with different aspirations and ideas. He says that sometimes a group may dissolve and a new group with different aspirations and ideas will form. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes, in all truth and honesty, it's really the same people. It's not so much that it dissolved, it just kind of changed form. the group. You know, most times if people have a strong feeling or a strong need to reach consensus or to get to a conclusion, the group may implode. It may dissolve. Yeah, people say the darn thing implodes. Yes. Yes and no. The group may shift and no longer meet on Tuesdays at 4 o'clock and be called the A group. But when it reforms because the problem still exists, the issues are still current, something still needs to be done, the next group will have very similar membership with some additions. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's hard for people to really change paths when they've worked hard in a certain direction. If you really need to do that, a lot of times the groups will dissolve and then reform. This is true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Vanessa says it's an entirely new direction. You need to create a timeline, restate the goals, and vote with majority agreement. Yeah, if you've got the right group and they can be that forward-seeing. If it's entirely new direction, you need to create a timeline. When do you think we're going to get to this point and this point and this point so we can progress? Restate the goals. Yes, sometimes the goals are the same, but what you're restating is how you're going to try to reach them. And vote so that you get majority agreement, so that you get consensus. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of not in favor of voting. It depends on the group. I know I said it depends again, but it does. Because it does make you all feel that it is what most people think. Yeah. Especially if the opinions are close. So create a timeline, restate the goals. I'm going to add not only the goals, but how you're going to get there, the practical process of it, and vote with majority agreement. Good point, Vanessa, and others, yeah. This is an interesting point that's being asked. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about, now the group needs to change direction completely. That's serious change. Because it's become kind of the present direction has become impossible. It's not working. And a lot of people are asking, basically speaking, who decides when the present direction becomes impossible? How do you know? How do you know that what you're doing ain't going to work? How do you know that it's just not, that you haven't given it enough time, right? Sometimes things take longer than you think they're going to take. So how do you know when it's become impossible? Yeah. How do you know that your present direction is no good? Mm-hmm. You know, Brian's making a good point that it depends why things have changed. Yeah. A lot of times, that's exactly the reason. It depends why. It depends why things have changed. If it's outside law changes, then it's more obvious that you cannot go forward. Sometimes something outside your group changes. The circumstances change. The regulations, the law, technology marches forward. And whatever it is that you wanted to do has changed. Sometimes it gets solved. Eureka. Hallelujah. Yes, we're done. Progress has reached us. But a lot of times there's an outside change that you have to accommodate, right? The law has changed, for example. Regulation has changed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sometimes it's an outside change. That tells you when it's become impracticable, no longer necessary, or you need to change shifts because some sort of lawmaker has done something that really impacts you. Mm-hmm. Pam says that you know that you need to change direction, and a lot of people are saying this. Thank you for all of your participation. That if prior attempts at resolution have failed, mm-hmm. which I suppose leads us to the question of how many attempts do you make, but you kind of know you kind of know if the group is tired. You know, if we've tried it, we maybe tried it more than once. We made it all the way to what we thought was the resolution, and it just didn't have an impact. It failed. It didn't. It was either failed directly or failed in the fact that nothing that we thought was going to happen happened. Mm-hmm. And Pam and others are saying that if that happens, then you may need new tactics. And the change is how to approach it in the new tactics. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, Kevin and others, this is an interesting point, too, that sometimes you know that you need to change because you've brought in an expert, and the expert brought in to give opinions recommended a new direction. Yeah, you brought in an expert, and they went, no, I think you're going to need to rethink that. Yeah, that means, well, you brought him in, and now you've heard the expert opinion. We can't discuss it, of course, and we don't have to do what the expert says. But if it's someone that we agreed that we thought was good, well, now we've got something to think about, don't we? A new direction that we might need to go because the expert had an opinion about why we weren't being successful. Because quite frankly, if it was going really, really well, yeah, exactly. If it was going really, really well, you wouldn't ask for an expert. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or you didn't know. You know, this is the other side that people are saying, thank you for all of your participation. Sometimes an expert will look at something and go, well, no, you can't do that because, I don't know, science dictates it. You know what I mean? There's a real reason. You go, uh-oh, none of us was an expert, and we didn't know that. Aha, time for change. Yeah, Anna says that sometimes issues have changed because a solution has been instituted. Yeah, sometimes part of it's been solved. Something's been invented, something has hit the market, something, there's a regulation or law that's not stupid, and the issues have changed because a solution has been instituted. Yeah, something's gone right. And it wasn't even our doing, or maybe we had some influence, but we don't have to worry about that part anymore. And then you change, you say, well, what's left? you know, yeah, that's an interesting point. I think this is kind of an American thing, but I happen to be an American, and this is a global show, of course. But you know, there was an organization called the March of Dimes, and their disease got cured. Basically speaking, you know, they didn't have a purpose anymore. They collected money for, people are telling me different kinds of diseases. I don't know what the March of Dimes really did. But whatever it was, it got cured, right? And so they shifted gears to something else that needed funding. You know, they still exist. It's just that their main focus, it was a good thing. It got taken care of. Right? Yeah. So people were saying it was the Salk vaccine that did it. Good. Well, you know, but something got invented that caused them not to have so many issues anymore. And then the issue was, what are we going to do? And Eric and others are saying that sometimes the situation can become worse and you need to accelerate the process. Oh, my goodness, it's gotten worse. Usually that happens when some sort of a law or regulation comes into effect. Things have gotten worse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Lynn and others are saying that you need to reach consensus on what needs to be done and how the group should go about doing it. And that's really just about the basic thought that, yeah, that whatever it is that we need to, we'll change together, whatever we need to change. Mm-hmm. We will change together. Sometimes, if it's too disruptive, we will dissolve and reform. But we will do it in a convivial manner, right? You know, that's why Recipe for Peace now advocates doing the, yes, I am. People are going, are you getting to the recipes? Yes, I am. We're running out of time, aren't we? And thank you for all of your participation. But that's why we advocate having frequent timeouts and having some food and a way to just mingle and have a private conversation and to get together so that when we come back as a formal group in the room, we have reached some consensus and an idea of where we're going in the informal parts. You know, I always say that the food is a tool. It is not really because we're so hungry. All right, it might be dinner. We might be hungry. But it's really a tool to get people together and talking to each other. And yes, it's a nasty little overused word, but networking, so that we can reach consensus and have the process go smoothly and not just, you know, be kind of dislike each other and therefore I'm not going to communicate, I'm not going to participate. No, we're going to avoid doing things like that, aren't we? So, yeah, that's the key to it, that it needs to be a consensus building event, so to speak. And, yes, I'm about to say what I always say before we start the food part of the show, the recipe part, because we're going to have a couple of recipes for sharing. Now, the thing that you need to do, and yes, it's all archived on the blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow or on the website recipeforpeacenow.com. But yes, I say this each time because it's so important. Whenever you're going to have a community get-together with food, however it is you have been communicating, email, phone call, whatever it is you've been doing, you need to communicate to the entire group whether or not anyone has an allergy, a food allergy, a food prohibition, or a religious prohibition. You do not want anyone to have a bad time, right? Very, very important. And you will tell everyone that when they bring food, they need to have it labeled. Not what is it, meatloaf, but what's in it. So that you can, so people can decide whether or not they can eat it. Very, very important. Yes. So we're going to take the survey about allergies, food prohibitions, and religious prohibitions concerning food. And also we're going to label our food. And we're going to be very careful about it. Right? Right. Also, I suppose it's because I really hate running out of food. But I think that the host, they have the responsibility to bring a little bit extra. And I like to bring a safe recipe. Sometimes I bring an adventure one too. But I like to bring a safe recipe for sure. Now, what's a safe recipe? Well, it's a recipe that does not have too many ingredients, not too complicated. Most of the ingredients can basically be seen. And what is in there does not violate any known allergy, food prohibition, or religious prohibition. And the ingredients are such that in your area, because, you know, I'm in the United States, so my people are different than your people. This is a global show. But in your area, there is a real fine chance that everybody has eaten the ingredients that's in it. They're familiar with them. It's not going to be a surprise. So this is the safe recipe this time. It is a lovely chicken and rice casserole. I don't know, I like a casserole because then you can just put a big spoon in it and people can take as much as they want. So here we go. We're going to have 3 cups of cooked chicken that you're going to dice up. Yeah, make sure it's nice and cooked. 2 cups of cooked rice. We're going to cook it already and drain it, of course. We're going to have, well, we're going to have about a pound of peas. Now, if you're me, you're going to use frozen peas. Because it's easy, it's cheap, and they're delicious. You're going to do a thing like that. You need to thaw them and pat them down so that they don't add liquid to your casserole. You don't want to have that little ice stuff all over your casserole because it's not nice, and it's kind of different to the temperature. Mm-hmm. If you're going to use fresh peas, you're a finer person than I am. Yes. Let's have a cup of diced celery. Mm-hmm. Always looks nice in there. And I like about 1.5 cups of nice fresh mushrooms that we're going to slice. Mm-hmm. Don't use, well, if you must use the canned ones for mushrooms, they're frozen ones, really? I didn't know that. If you must use the canned ones, put them in later because they're softer, right? And really, really, really drain them. Pat them all dry and everything. I think they've got kind of an icky consistency, but that's just me and it's probably unfair. We're going to have like half a cup of chopped onion, a small onion that we're going to chop up real nice and fine. About a teaspoon of dried rosemary that we're going to crush. And I'm going to use condensed cream of mushroom soup or condensed cream of chicken soup, depending what you like. I like the chicken better, I think. It's easy for me to get. It's a condensed soup. If not, you can use cream and like that and make your own condensed. But I think it's real easy, and it's one regular can, one of those 10-ounce cans, and 3/4 of a cup of mayonnaise. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. It's going to be delicious. Mm-hmm. And then for the topping, because it doesn't get mixed in, I like cornflakes. You know how you crush cornflakes? Not the fine crumbs that you get in a package. All right, in the States they come in a package. You could get really fine cornflake crumbs. They're not it. I like to have crumbled cornflakes. In all truth and honesty, I don't even hit them with a rolling pin. As I take the cornflakes out of the box, I just kind of crumble them in my hand because it makes nice big crunchy pieces. Yes, people that go in fried onions for the top. Ooh, I know. Yes, it just a safer recipe, really. In the United States, and I don't know about other places, you can actually get crispy fried onions in a package. And, yes, I'm afraid it is absolutely yummy. And, no, I don't usually – people are already revising this recipe. You know that, of course, all of these recipes are general thoughts, and you can revise them any way you want. I tend to cook somewhat blandly. I don't usually use a lot of spice because I feel that if you want to put jalapenos in the thing, that they should be in a little dish on the side and people can make that choice. I usually put spicy things like that on the side so that if you really, really like it spicy, you look at the jalapenos, you look at the casu, you say, that doesn't have much spice in it, and you put some jalapenos in there or some Tabasco sauce or something. Yes. But anyway, fried onions are lovely on the top of casseroles. This is true. Yeah. Okay. So we've got our ingredients. And we're going to get ourselves a nice big casserole. And we're going to mix the first ingredients up to the soup and the mayonnaise. So we're going to mix together the chicken and the rice and the celery and the mushrooms and the onion and the rosemary, right? We're going to combine all of them because, of course, the chicken's already cooked, right? Right. You heard that part, right? Yeah, because you don't want – otherwise, it's a bad thing. Yeah. Now, we've got it all mixed together in the casserole, right? Now we're going to whisk together the soup and the mayonnaise. Mix them all together. And now we're going to mix the dressing, so to speak, the soup and the mayonnaise in with the dry stuff, the other stuff. We're going to mix it all around. And we're going to stick it into a greased 2-quart baking dish. Well, maybe a bigger than a 2-quart because it's going to overflow. The way I cook, I like to make lots and then I don't run out. And so it's all blended together with the soup and the mayonnaise as the binder, so to speak. If you're going to use breadcrumbs, now is your moment. I usually melt a couple of tablespoons of butter and I crush the breadcrumbs and kind of mix them in with the melted butter, right? So that it's nice and on the top. Sprinkle that all over the top. You bake it uncovered, because we want to make it nice and brown, in about a 350-degree oven for 30 minutes. Couldn't be simpler. You've got all of your pre-made stuff. Your chicken's cooked. Your rice is cooked. You mix it all together. You put in the dressing, so to speak, the soup and the mayonnaise. Yeah, sometimes I give more than 3/4 of a cup of mayonnaise. Oops. A whole cup is also nice because it all incorporates nicely. Mm-hmm. And you sprinkle you can use breadcrumbs. I don't know. I don't usually. You sprinkle the cornflakes on the top. People are saying to put Parmesan cheese also because it makes it nice and bubbly and brown. Always lovely also. And you bake it in a 350 for about half an hour. Delicious. It stays warm for a long time. When you bring it someplace, you can reheat it. Mm-hmm. All good. And it is very, very popular. And that is our safe recipe because it has ingredients that people are familiar with and generally not allergic to. And, yes, your condensed soup is probably a dairy item and like that. So you have to tell people about it. but you have made a decision concerning the allergies and food prohibitions. So that's our safe recipe. Now we're going to go for our adventure recipe. It's our adventure recipe because it has a few things that people might not have eaten in my area. And also, I must confess that we're going to have beef stroganoff, and I add some brandy to it because I think it gives it a wonderful flavor. And because, I don't know, I think that whoever I got the recipe from said to give brandy to it. So it's kind of like, yes, I think it's yummy. But some people object to having any kind of a liquor in their food. Yeah, okay. So here's beef stroganoff. It's a real basic recipe. Yes, yes. We're going to have 2 pounds of like a beef tenderloin, something that's not too terrible chewy. Yeah, maybe round steak, whatever you think. We're going to cut that we're going to trim off the fat, right? And we're going to cut it into thin strips. The thinner you can get it, the better. You know that if you put the meat not in the freezer because you don't want to break your hand or your knife, but if you have the meat be cold, it is easier to slice it with a very sharp knife than if it's kind of room temperature because it's more soft. So if you make the meat kind of firmer, it'll be easier to cut. We're going to cut it into strips. We're going to trim the fat off and we'll cut it into nice little strips. About 2 tablespoons of butter. Yes, use butter. Don't use anything else. 2 onions that we're going to thinly slice. Use a mandolin on it. About 1 cup of chicken broth, chicken stock. Chicken stock. You can use beef stock, too. I think it makes it a little too salty, but that's just me. So I think chicken stock is better. But either way, whatever you've got. 1 teaspoonful of sweet paprika. That's one of the things that in my area would not be something that everybody has eaten. But beef stroganoff needs the coloring and the flavor of a little bit of paprika. 1/2 pound of mushrooms that we're going to slice. How about some tarragon? 1/2 teaspoon of it, dried tarragon, we're going to crumble. 2 cups of sour cream. Because it's going to be delicious with the sour cream. Well, is that too much sour cream? Well, 1½ cups of sour cream. You can adjust it if you want, depending on how kind of creamy you want it to look. And some fresh dill, 3 teaspoons of fresh dill. Always looks nice in it. It gives it that nice flavor, that nice beef stroganoff flavor. So we're going to melt our butter, and we're going to add 1/2 of the beef because you can't get it all in your pot if you've got a big frying pan or something, because we're having a couple pounds, it's too much. What we're going to do is we're going to do the meat without crowding it, brown it on both sides. You know, you get your tongs out and you brown it on both sides. And you take that batch out and you put it on a plate, you put the next batch in, you brown it on all sides. You know what I mean. You put it in the pan, you brown it on all sides, all the meat. You put it to the side in a plate. Yeah. And so now it's all cooked. It takes a couple minutes on each side, right? If you don't do this, you will be sorry. You must brown the meat. And really that cooks the meat through too. But it also seals in the goodness. It makes the meat edible. So we've now got all the meat done, right? It's browned on both sides. And we're going to the same pot. We're going to probably reduce the heat a little bit. And we're going to put in the onion. And we're going to cook it until it's soft, which is about 5 minutes. And we're going to add 1/2 the broth and the paprika. And we're going to cook it again for about 5 minutes longer until everything is incorporated and nice and hot. Now we're going to add our mushrooms, our tarragon, maybe a little salt and pepper. I am careful with the salt and pepper because we're using stock, and that oftentimes is a little bit saltier too. And you've heard that I like to put salt and pepper to the side because how salty things are is personal. So we're going to add the mushrooms and the tarragon, and we're going to cook it. And we're going to cook it until the mushrooms are nice and tender, but not all wilted. And it'll take, about 6 minutes, 7 minutes, and until the liquid by now will have pretty much evaporated. It's not wet anymore. You know what I mean? You could add a little bit, more stock to look at it, but it should be not too much liquid. Mm-hmm. Now, you remember our beef that we browned? Yeah, we're going to put it back in. We're going to put in some more stock. Stir it all around. We're going to put in our sour cream. Mm-hmm. We're going to look at it and make sure that we're not putting too much sour cream so that it looks nice and beautiful, but not like meat swimming in sour cream, right? And we're going to put, well, we have 3 teaspoons of dill that we talked about. Let's put in 2 teaspoons. Mm-hmm. And we're going to cook it until it's all hot, but not putting it to a boil because that'll curdle the sour cream and it won't be nice. You've got to heat it all through because your meat's gone cold, right? Right. And this step with the heating through can be done when you get also to the location, which I assume has a stove, some way of keeping it warm. Mm-hmm. And it'll take about a couple of minutes. And then I like to bring with a little bit more dill, just like a teaspoonful, not a lot, to sprinkle it on top. Mm-hmm. Now, did I mention that you can also add brandy at the meat just before the meat goes in, right? When you've got the mushrooms and the tarragon and the onions and the broth and everything in there. Before you stir in the meat, in the sauce, I like to put in a couple tablespoons of brandy because it adds that extra flavor to it. But that's what makes it an adventure recipe too. It's the paprika, which is somewhat unusual around here. Tarragon's not real common either, I don't think. Maybe not even dill. People are saying dill also. And it's got dairy, of course, but that you can see. And it's the brandy that makes it an even more adventure recipe. So you can decide how you think about that. But look, it's delicious. It's wonderful. Everybody likes it. And yes, it is traditionally served on pasta, on noodles. A lot of you know because you've been here before, and thank you for all of your participation. A lot of you know that I think that even though stroganoff is usually served on like a fettuccine noodle, a fettuccine pasta, something long and narrow, I think it is oftentimes neater in the room to have a pasta that is more in individual pieces, like a rotini or something shorter, that you don't need to have twirling of the fork with. Yeah. And I serve that on the side. I just put a big bowl, and people can take as much as they want. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it usually goes with the pasta. George always votes for mashed potatoes. Yes, hello, George. And, yeah, so you can put everything you want on the side there. People do like rice under everything, and there's nothing wrong with that. And rice is, of course, a little more healthful than pasta, I suppose. But, yeah, you serve a starchy item for this to go on top of. Mm-hmm. Oh, my, people are saying toast. Well, whatever you like, whatever you think the people like. And yes, and oftentimes I have several different choices because people do like the plain item underneath things. And yes, a lot of you know that one of the few things I have that is a single piece is a rice cooker just because I do it so much. And you can just bring it like that. So I see that our time together is nearly up. My goodness, that went fast. Thank you for all of your participation. Thank you for listening. I always learn something, and I hope you did too. If you would like to find us, we are at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website is www.recipeforpeacenow.com. If you would like to hear prior shows, all of the shows are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. The last 5 shows, the most recent 5, including this one, just about when we get off the air, are archived at our website at recipeforpeacenow.com. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for listening. And please do come again. And thank you for all of your participation. Please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.